Hello, welcome to the Long Shot Leaders Podcast. I'm Michael Stein. My guest today is Karina Oliani. Karina is the Guinness World Record holder for traversing the largest volcano in planet Earth in Ethiopia. She has gone into the deepest depths of the ocean that a human being can go to, and she's also climbed Mount Everest on several different angles. She has been all over the world, all with all kinds of animals, wrestling sharks and alligators and all kinds of animals that you probably never even heard of. She's done it all when it comes to the outdoors. It's a remarkable person. She keeps on one-upping herself. We're really lucky to talk to her. Just an amazing skill set and a very interesting person that's also philanthropic. As she was traveling across the world, she decided, you know, I need to become a doctor and be a specialized doctor for the places I'm going to. It's really interesting. Here is Karina Oliani. All right, I'm here with Karina Oliani. And we are going to take a journey, you know, because I was telling her in the pregame, every once in a while you read somebody's bio and you get tired because there's so many milestones. Now you have been in the ocean, you've been in the highest peaks, all different ways to climb up Mount Everest. She's traversed a world's record for the, the largest volcano in Ethiopia. And what I'm going to do, what I like to do, is that, and then she also got into medicine. You know, she's studying the human body, but I want to go into the human soul. I want to, you know, discover you. So we're going to go back to when you were a little kid. Did you grow up in Brazil?
Yes, in São Paulo.
Right, in São Paulo, where you're at right now. Now, mom and dad, how did this come about? Were they outdoors people, or what do they do for a living?
Not really, Michael. I think since I'm a little kid, I've been a little unique in that sense. I have two sisters, and my sisters are very normal girls. They used to love playing with their dolls inside like a little dollhouse we had. And I was always like outside of the dollhouse trying to abseil down from the ceiling or, you know, doing crazy stuff. And my parents, they just mentioned how different the way I'd like to play was from other girls of my age and my time. They use it to mention, I would say, hey, now I'm going to traverse the Atlantic. So bye, I'm going to cruise the ocean, or I'm going to, you know, climb Everest and climb a mountain. So since I'm a very little kid, I'm fascinated by exploring and big adventures. And that just grew up with me. You know, as I grew older, the adventures grew bigger, and here I am now.
Your sisters, who's the oldest, youngest, middle, who out of the three?
I'm the oldest, and I have another one, which is almost my age, the middle one, and one that was born on the same day, 3 years later than me.
Wow. So you have to share the same birthday with your little sister?
Exactly. Interesting, huh? And that it wasn't planned, as my parents say, it wasn't planned at all.
Well, this is interesting. So usually the oldest is the responsible one. You know, the young one is the adventurous one. Do your sisters have adventure in their hearts like you do today? Or what do they do?
Well, my younger sister, just like me, she's a doctor as well, but she doesn't work with emergency and expedition medicine, but she does work with sports medicine, and she loves to ski and snowboard, like to be in the mountains, but to go down, not to climb up. Like I do. I had a lot to do with influencing my sisters to explore and to be more adventurous, and even to have some accidents, you know, when we were younger, because I was always trying to take them out and to push limits and to challenge ourselves. And the way I used to play with my sisters was like this.
When you look back on the first moment that there was a big milestone of like you being getting involved in adventure, you know, I don't know what I read that it was, you were 12 years old, or you said maybe 10 years old, you parachuted out of a plane. What was the very first milestone that you said this was a big step?
Well, I think there were a few of them. Definitely the tandem jump when I was 12 years old, and my parents really didn't want me to skydive, of course, but I made a deal with them, and they had to you know, to keep their promises, because they said like their words is worth, you know, it's more important than anything. So they just said, you have to follow what you say and keep your promises. And then I said, hey, aren't you keeping yours? So they had to take me to skydive when I was 12. But I think when I was 15, I went to Australia to do like, you know, kind of an exchange program to learn better English. That didn't work out so well. My English is super
pretty
rusty.
Pretty good, I must say.
But
English is a hard language to learn. It sounds like it. But you've done so much traveling that you get to exercise your English.
Exactly. So I went to Australia and I was living off the Gold Coast when I walked by a surf life saving club in Surfers Paradise Beach. And I'm like, what is this surf life saving stuff, you know? And I entered the club and I started seeing all those lifesavers training and swimming and lifting weights and like doing all the rescue with people. And of course, I already loved the rescue part of the thing. So I'm like, I really want to do that. And they told me, hey, Karina, it's not, you know, you need to be born in Australia and you need to live here. And it's something, it's long term and you don't speak that good of an English. And you were so small, you were a 15-year-old girl and you're not going to be able to rescue big guys. And can you see the surf is big here in Surfers Paradise? So, yeah, we'd love to have you, girl, but it's not for you. And, you know, they were kind of nice, but they were very honest and straightforward. And I loved that. And it was such a big challenge for me because all they said was true. I was a small girl and, you know, the rescues were done in big waves and everything was true. But I wanted to take the chance because I started swimming when I was 3 years old. And I swam for my entire life. And, you know, water is like my element. If I had to choose one, water is that. I feel really at home when I'm in the ocean. So I'm like, hey, I agree with you. You have a point. It's all that. But you have tests. And all the people, they have to go through the written test. They have to go through the physical test. And then they go to the ocean and they do the final test. And I want to have that opportunity. I know I don't fit your outlines here, but please just give me the opportunity of taking the tests. And I really think that when they answered yes, they were thinking that on the first written test, because of all the English words and everything, I was already going to fail and stop right there. But for everybody's surprise, I did really well. And I was first in my class because I'm very like nerd. When I want to do something, I just go with all my soul and my very best. Like I studied a lot for that test. And I did very well. And then they took me to the swimming pool. And on the physical test, I was not first, but I did pretty average. I was like 50% with all the other guys and boys that were very fit. So I was very happy. And when I went to the ocean, it was a huge day. You know, the waves were big and there was a little of storm. It was rainy and kind of stormy. And they were like very worried to do the ocean test on that day. But in the end, the director said, hey, this is what you are going to have to face with. You are going to have to rescue people when it's good days and when it's bad days. So you all go to the ocean and it's going to be a big day. But if anything happens, we'll just come and take you. And they did. They had to rescue like three guys from the ocean because the surf was so big. But they didn't have to rescue me, and I finished. I didn't do super well because it was very, very challenging. But I made it out of the water safely, and I fit their numbers, you know. So, yeah, I took the bronze medallion when I was 15 years old in Australia. Just being there after 3 months, I was there. So I wasn't super experienced. But then I kept working with the surfers lifesaving that had more experience than me. And I did really well. I learned a lot from them and I evolved from them, you know, and that was a big thing for me because I saw that even though something looks like impossible, but if you throw all your heart and all your energy towards that challenge, you can do it. And yeah, when I went back to Brazil, I had a different thought about myself and my references were lifted. I don't know if I can say that way in English, but yeah, I rose all my references about how to go about things. And I started proposing like myself bigger challenges. I just wanted to go bigger each time on rock climbing, on diving, on swimming, and all the sports I use it to do.
Did you know what you wanted to do at this point when you got back? Like, did you have an idea? This is what I want to make my life. Or you're just kind of, no, I want to do challenges and the next thing, but not thinking about this is the direction I want to go in for my life's mission, my life's work, my life's passion.
Yeah, that's very odd. Like, I wanted to become a marine biologist because I was so in love with the ocean. You know, I always loved so much either oceanography or a marine biologist. That was my goal. But then I applied for the test on the best university of marine biology in the world at that time, which was James Cook University up north in Cairns, Australia. And yes, I was accepted and my parents said, no, come back. You're going to live by us and we want to have you close and you're already so many months far away, just come back because we want to be a family and we want you closer to us and we miss you so much. So I came back and then my parents convinced me not to go back to Australia.
What did they do for a living? Tell me about your parents real quick because I want to know their personalities and I'm just curious.
Well, my dad, he had a dream of being a doctor, but here in Brazil, things are not super easy, as you know, economy. And my dad didn't have the funds to go to medical school. And he had to work since he was very young. So, but I'm super proud of him because he's a self-made man.
What kind of work did he get into?
Well, he started driving trucks and taking loads from one place to the other. And although he wanted to be a doctor, he was very clever with maths and number. He's a genius when we talk about maths and calculation. You know, he can do everything in his head without needing a machine to. Yeah, so, well, he did super well in this business and with the numbers. And he started his own company like 10 years later. And he's a very stubborn man in the good way. Like, he worked super hard and he became the owner of the company that once he was driver.
Wow, that's great. He's an entrepreneur. How about your mom?
Yeah, my mom, she had a job at a bank. But when she was very young, when she had me, she was 24 years old. And straight after that, she had two more daughters and they didn't have any help at home. So she couldn't really work. She had to take care of three small kids.
Right.
And it is a lot of work. It's just an unrecognized work, you know, but taking care of three kids and a house, it's just a lot. And now that I'm a mother, I can tell you that because to take care of my 10-month-old baby, it's like a full-time job.
I got two daughters. I can't imagine having three. So You get back from Australia. They ain't letting you go. They love you. You're a tight-knit family. Now, how do your milestones create this empire? I would call it an empire. You know, I mean, obviously social media had a lot to do with it. You know, when that came out, how do you build this mini empire that you created?
Well, I didn't really had a way to go. I had to find my own way. Like, as I told you, I was going to be a marine biologist, but then I started following some marine biologists here in Brazil, and I realized I didn't really like their work. I didn't really enjoy what they had to do on a daily basis. I just wanted to be close to the ocean, but that was not the way. So I always loved science a lot. And I started thinking what would be the other thing that I would enjoy doing for work. And of course, medicine struck me very strongly because I always loved to help people and to rescue people like when they most need it. And then I just decided I was going to do emergency medicine. And when I applied for medical school, it's just super hard to go inside medical school here in Brazil. It's like 1,000 people to one spot. And now it's even more. It's like 2,000 people for one spot. So it's not easy. You have to study a lot. I had to study fully for 3 years to get in the medical school. But when I did, it was such a challenge for me that I'm like, okay, I'm fully in, and I did all the years it took me. And when I graduated, I wasn't completely happy because doctors, they are always trapped indoors. You know, they're always inside an ER room or inside the OR doing operations, or they are doing medical consultations, and they have lots of jobs and they work long, long hours all over the world, but here in Brazil especially. So I was like, okay, that's not what I want to do with my life, although I love emergency medicine. So I started like finding a way out, because of course the problem we always have problem is life, you know, and it's good because it makes us get out of our comfort zone and create other paths and see things the other ways. And I looked out for a fellowship in Utah in the USA called Wilderness Medicine. And I got in contact with this super inspiring person called Paul Ablett. He was my teacher for many years. He was my mentor too. Right now he passed away, but he's like the biggest name, one of the biggest names in the world regarding wilderness medicine. And I had the pleasure of studying with him, learning from him. And yeah, I went to the US and I took this fellow on wilderness medicine. When I got back, combining my emergency medical background with the wilderness medicine, I founded and I was the first president of the Brazilian Wilderness Medicine Society. So I took this specialty, medical specialty to Brazil, and I started promoting that all over Brazil. And it grew very quickly because, of course, you know, Brazil, we have a long coastline and we have dunes and we have jungle and, well, so much outdoors here. And that was a big thing too, because I went from having to explain people what wilderness medicine is, they had no clue, to right now, like we have, I don't know, but more than 500 medical doctors that are affiliated to our society and that are doing this type of medicine here. And yeah, that was very cool for me. I went back and I specialized in mountain medicine, altitude medicine, and that led me to Everest. Because Peter Hackett, one of my teachers, which is an amazing altitude doctor from Colorado, he's like, Karina, I got an invitation to be the personal doctor of this group that is climbing Everest next season, but I can't go, unfortunately. I can't leave the US. So can I recommend you to be their doctor? And I'm like, yes, please, of course.
How old were you at this point?
Well, it was 28, I think. 29. Yeah, wow. I was already graduated, but I was a young doctor. But yeah, I had my fellowship and I had some experience in mountaineering because I rock climbed and I did Kilimanjaro, Aconcagua, mountains in the Andes, Bolivia, in the Alps. So I already loved to climb.
Yeah, and you know what's great, real quick, what's great about your story real quick is that you're traveling around the world, you know, and you're doing all these things even before Everest, and then you get to involve with medicine. And now if you study six human need psychology, what fulfills people is certainty, uncertainty, which is variety, love, contribution, and growth. And now you're able to get adventure, you're able to get significance through your adventures, but now you're also able to contribute. You're able to feel like you're growing, you know, and you're getting love because you're helping people, and it just adds so much more richness to your expeditions or your adventures, right? And then you get this, I mean, what is Everest? I'm sure it was always in the back of your mind. And then you get to work there. Were you like pinching yourself thinking things are really starting to hit a critical mass here to where there's a lot of momentum in my career and my life at that point?
Well, Everest was definitely one of those milestones, you say, you know, one turning point of my career, because when I went to work on Everest, of course, after I finished my work 4 months at base camp, I really wanted to climb that mountain because of my personality and because of my love for my passion for mountaineering. But I didn't have the funds, just the authorization, like the climbing permit, the Nepali government charges you, it's more than $10,000 right there, boom. You know, and I was like, okay, if just the permit's $10,000, I'm going to need to go back and work a lot more to be able to come back and climb this mountain. And, you know, everybody knows, but climbing Everest is around $60,000 or more for a
weird. You're the first one I've interviewed, like three or four people that have done that. And I'm so happy. I've never knew that it costs that much money. There's a lot of money involved, just not the travel, but to actually climb that mountain, there's fees.
Yeah, it's one of the most, it is the most expensive mountain in the world if we are talking about commercial mountaineering. And it is also the tallest one. But anyways, that was 2010. And I'm like, okay, I'll go back. I will work so hard for 1 year. I'll do all the medical shifts I can get to be able to go back next year and pay for my expedition. But of course that didn't happen. It's just too much money when you convert Brazilian reais for US dollars. And I started going after sponsors, because I already had some contacts on Brazilian television, and I knew how to make like a television show. So I'm like, okay, let's see if, there's not many Brazilian people who climbed Everest at that time. I think I was like number 10 or something, you know, like second or third girl to Brazilian woman to climb Everest. So I'm like, okay, I've never seen a show on Brazilian television about climbing Everest, and I'm going to make a very good one and tell all the truth and show how hard it is and show everything the way it is. And, well, I invited a guy from Utah, Scott Simper. He's an amazing mountain cameraman, and he came along climbing with me, and he filmed and registered all the best and the worst moments of our expedition. And that went off on Brazilian television like a few months after I came back from Everest climbing 2013. And that went huge in Brazil, like huge. People loved it. I got thousands and thousands of messages of, oh my God, I didn't know you could take a shower when climbing Everest. And the other one, oh my God, I didn't know your hair would freeze on a very cold day. And how, you know, like all these people going crazy about how do you poo-poo on Everest, and even like the smallest things from the very big things like avalanches and everything that happened on that expedition. And that really was like a turning point on my career, because all the sponsors and big brands started looking at me differently, and that provided me the funds I needed to go bigger on my adventures, on the next adventures, you know? So just so you have an idea, the first time I climbed Everest, it took me 3 years to get 3 sponsors and to get the funds to go climb Everest once. But after I climbed Everest in 2013, it took me 10 days to get all the funds to climb the north face of Everest.
You're like you became a celebrity in Brazil. Most of your funding came from Brazil, right?
Yeah. Well, there were some Japanese brands, some American brands, but yeah, it's all Brazilian based companies. And yeah, I'm very grateful to them. And most of them still my partners today, because we did so many cool things together, not only regarding mountains, but also like I did another series. Remember, I told you I'm passionate about the oceans and marine biology. So I was able to suggest a series called Wild Oceans for Channel Off here in Brazil. And I was able to dive with the largest predators of the oceans, like great white sharks, no cage, tiger sharks, sperm whales, crocodiles, stellar sea lions, anacondas. Like I was able to dive with a super huge long anaconda, and that was all over Japan, UK, and you know, all over. People like, oh, this Brazilian daredevil faces the terrible, deadly anaconda.
Let me explain to everybody. She's right there in the water, right in front of these things, like maybe like a meter, not even like 2 feet away from like these a great white shark and all these animals. And like I saw that anaconda. I didn't even know anacondas can go underwater like that, like in the ocean. I thought they'd always be like kind of near more, so land is like totally submersed. It's scary. It's crazy.
No, the anaconda is a more aquatic animal than it stays much more under the water than outside, you know. And it's a great swimmer. And yeah, like, so yeah, this series was amazing. I was able like to go to Iceland, dive with orcas, and you know, from very cold waters to Caribbean waters, I was able to fulfill all these dreams that I had as a kid, and I wanted to be a marine biologist. And I'm like, okay, I did the right thing, because being a marine biologist, I don't think I would do all this that I did in 2 years of filming this amazing series, you know. And again, the series went very big in Brazil and also abroad. So yeah, I had a great opportunities. I'm super grateful for, it's like when I'm telling you, it seems like my life, it's her life is just a big vacation, you know. It's just like going on holidays, but I work so much and I had to go through so much to be able to pull out all those things. People don't see that, but believe me, it wasn't like super easy and only roses, you know.
It seems like you're always trying to, looking at all these accomplishments, you know, that you're trying to top yourself to the next thing. Cause then you go on top of an airplane and then you're sitting there on the wing. It's flying by itself. You get up from the cockpit, you know, those two propeller planes. I'm explaining to everybody. I know, you know. So then I'm like, you get it out of the plane. You're sitting there on top of the top wing of this wing plane. And you're just like flying on top of it with your feet in these braces, flying on top of a plane, with your arms stretched out. It's crazy. I mean, what, now that was before the volcano, right? Or after?
No, that was before the volcano. That was another series. So television was the way I found to suggest crazy things to people. And they don't think I'm crazy. They just say, yes, let's do it. Okay. Because if you say you're doing, you know, you have green card and people say, yeah, I'll buy your project, it's for TV. So this is called wing walking. And there's many wing walkers all over the world. But this family, especially the Mansons, they live just up north of Seattle. And they are this amazing family. I think it's 6 or 7 kids. And since they are very young, all they talk about and all they play with are planes. So their mom is a professional wing walker and their dad is a professional airplane pilot, acrobatic and commercial pilot. And the kids, they breathe airplanes, you know, and it's so amazing because I got there and I thought I was doing like this great adventure and this big thing. But then it just comes out to like this 13-year-old and he's like, oh, dad, can I wing walk this afternoon? And dad was like, yeah, after Karina goes, you go. I was like, okay. Just like, you know, when you ask your dad, hey, dad, can I go to the gym today or can I go play basketball? And he was like, can I wing walk this afternoon? And I was like, cool.
Yeah. Okay. Now this is interesting though, because this segue is really nicely into everything you've done is amazing at this point. Everything, rarefied air, many, not 1/16 to 1% of the planet, maybe not even that, you know, has done these things. But then you say, I want to do something that no one has ever done. Three people told you that you were nuts, right? In the beginning, that were so-called, I guess, experts. You know, let's talk about your journey traversing the largest volcano, because it's a nice benchmark. And also, it just stretches your strength again, you know, to go onto these things. And you traverse this in Ethiopia, this largest volcano, you know, that's great. You're wearing a space suit, it looks like. You know, it's really a lot of science has to go into this thing for you to do this. It looks crazy. Please explain to us this journey and, you know, why you got to, how you got the idea and how, just tell us about all about it.
So, yeah, you know, those crazy dreams you have when you were a kid by watching cartoons and, you know, the woodpecker is like traversing a lava lake and you were like, yeah, cool, maybe that's possible. Well, I always was fascinated by fire. I like fire a lot. So whenever we are in a, you know, like not survival situation, but whenever we are outdoors or camping or any, I'm the one who make fire and I love to do that. And lava is like such a hypnotizing thing for me. I can stare at lava for hours and don't move, don't blink. So, well, once I came to Hawaii and I was staring all that lava and I'm like, wow, this is so amazing. And years later, I came out with this project that three volcanologists told me, you are suicidal and you're going to kill yourself. And this is not possible. And I was trying to find a partner to pull out, you know, because you never do such a big thing by yourself. You need like a team and you need good people with you. So it took me a lot. That was the longest part. It was to find someone who was capable to come with me and to keep me safe. At the same time, he would agree of putting like a girl in the middle of a lava lake with and signing the project. So yeah, I found this amazing guy. He lives out of just on the outskirts of Toronto area. And he happens to be one of the best rigging specialists in the world. And then I came to Canada to meet him personally because we had a call like this. And he was like, Karina, I'm not sure. This is crazy. But yeah, I'm willing to study more and I'm willing to, you know, let's keep talking. So he was the first guy who didn't finish the conversation within the first minute I told him my dream and my idea. So, and I told him like, hey, I'm going to have to film like this stellar sea lions and I'm diving out of Vancouver Island. So when I come to Canada, I'll go through Toronto. So when I do my layover, maybe we can go and talk and I can show you everything that I've seen and I've studied from this volcano. And so I took all these Google Earth images and all the measures and everything from other people who's visited this lava lake. And I was telling him what was the idea. And he's like, I think this rope would work, but then I would need like a special clothing for. And we started talking and he does stunts for Hollywood and big projects like this. And he's like, okay, I'm not sure this is going to work out, but if you're willing to pay for that and if you're willing to put yourself there, I agree with you, we'll go, we do everything we can, and if we think it's safe, then you traverse and let's do it. His name is Frederick, and Frederick came with me to Ethiopia, and we were sleeping and camping by the lava lake for 4 days, and we didn't find any good rigging spot. So when it was the fourth day and Frederick was looking at me and I was looking at him, and we already had like this super disappointed faces, like, okay, we came all this way, but really it's impossible. And yeah, we've been going all over the crater and there's not one spot that wouldn't break. Like when you put a little pressure on the rigging, boom, it would explode, you know, and all the screws and everything would come out because it's just lava lake, lava rock, and this lava rock super thin. Well, so we were almost giving up, and then it was late at night because during the day it's just so hot. It's in this place considered to be one of the hottest deserts on Earth, called Dalakil Depression. And well, I told him, hey, it's almost night. I'm going to go by the lake and I'm going to have a look at, you know, a spot over there. He's like, oh, I'm coming with you. I'll take my gear. And we were there with the gear. And suddenly we just find this spot that I don't know why didn't break with my weight. So Frederick is like, okay, let me put your weight and my weight combined, because we need this to be very strong in order to put you in the middle. So both Frederick and I, we start like swinging on the rope and putting all our weight on that, and it didn't break. So Frederick is like, okay, it's not good enough for me. Let's go get the camera, the two camera people, and let's put the weight of at least three big men on this. And we need to find a second one. So we went back, they came with us, we started swinging, and we just found it. Like, it was amazing. It was almost, I don't know, something magical. And I just think the universe saw how much we were, you know, working hard for that to happen.
You found and that area, yeah, on one side. What about the others? Don't you have to have two sides of, you know, so you already had one on the other side, and then you were just looking for that last place on the other side so you can traverse across that cable or whatever it was?
Yeah, exactly. So when we went to the other side, we didn't find a spot that wouldn't, the rope would, you know, just friction on the rock. And of course, after traversing like more than 100 meters of rope, like three feet, yeah, that could just rip off and break. And what we had to do was a tripod with three very large, strong woods and elevate the rope out of the rock. But we did find a spot on the other side, and we had to come up with these tripods last minute. And it wasn't easy, you know. We took like thermometers. We were measuring the temperature many times with these wireless thermometers. Then we were studying the cycle of the volcano, because the volcano, it's like a live creature, you know. Sometimes the lava waves will explode and crazy and start like hitting the walls so strong, and then it gets dormant and it gets quieter, and all of a sudden it's absolutely dark and calm, and 3 minutes after it's gonna start everything again. And it has its cycle, so you have to study and understand the cycles of the volcano on that particular moment, so you know exactly when is the right moment to go. But of course, that's not like 100% guaranteed, you know, it's right. You have to take some chances when doing something like that for the first time. And yeah, we after we saw those two rigging points, we were very happy with that. And we said, okay, let's come back here. That was almost 2 a.m. when we left. And we are like, okay, let's come back here when it's almost sunrise and let's traverse it. And we did it. And yeah, we were so lucky because after we did it, it didn't take long for all the tripod and the system to collapse.
Okay. So wait. You put on this spacesuit. You start to traverse this thing. First of all, how long did it take to do the whole thing, to walk across?
Minutes, like 2 minutes at most.
Okay. How many, what was the distance? How many meters?
Well, in meters, it was a little over 100 meters.
Jesus. Okay. So now when the, you said that the cable started breaking, you went, that's after you, you traversed the whole thing and then it just broke right afterwards?
Not the rope, but the, you know, the wood tripod I told you?
Yeah. Yeah.
It came apart. Yeah. It happened straight after we went off. And well, it was, you know, just right and a very, very challenging thing to do. But I'm very happy to have found Frederick. He was really like the right person to be there and to study and do all this rigging and the rope work with me. And yeah, I'm still waiting to work again with him on some new other projects.
Do you send this stuff to like Guinness or they knew about it? You know, you have to go through a whole process because I think you were talking about Guinness, you know, and all that.
No, not at all. I didn't even know. Well, I knew that was a first, but I didn't have like the intention of being on the Guinness. But my boyfriend 3 years ago was like, he had a Guinness World Record already. And he's like, hey, you should get a Guinness World Record for yourself because many of the things you've done was a first. And I'm like, such as what? He was like, such as the lava lake you traversed. And I'm like, no, I'm sure some other people traversed other lava lake. I know this one was a first, but some other lava lake somewhere. And he got on the internet and he was like betting with me, nobody traversed anything longer than that. And he was happened to be right. So I'm like, okay, now that you started all this trouble, just go on this Guinness World Records. There was so many pages and so many things you have to fill to, yeah, to be able to apply for a record. And I'm not this type of person. I don't have the patience, you know, to be in the computer and putting all the numbers and like going back and looking at the footage and finding how long the rope was and finding exactly which suit.
When you traversed the Ethiopian lava crater, volcano, you didn't know that that was a world record?
No, I didn't know it was the longest lava lake traverse.
Amazing.
No?
I mean, you must have been like, holy shit, that's a world record. Would that have changed your mindset?
You know, because I was disappointed. I didn't want to traverse 100 meters. I wanted to traverse the entire diameter, like the longest diameter of the lava lake. But we didn't find the rigging spots exactly where I wanted. So the only place where we found the rigging spots was in one side of this oval, you know, this oval's circumference.
Right.
So I had to go where I could go, not where I wanted to go. And so for me, it was like, okay, I'm not really traversing it. I'm just going on the side, you know, and I'm doing this on the side. But when we looked at the footage and when everyone saw it, it was like, no, it was, shorter than what I wanted. But yes, it was a traverse. And it was considered by the GWR as a traverse and by everybody else. So I'm like, okay, one day maybe I'm able to do a longer one.
The footage is so dynamic and so impacting. You know, one thing I noticed about you in the short time we've been talking is that you have a very romantic, you know, philosophy about certain things, because when you talk about the elements of water and fire, it's very poetic. You know, have you noticed that, and do you consciously think about this in a spiritual kind of way, all these things?
Well, I'm in love with nature. I think we are part of it. We see ourselves sometimes as something, you know, out there, but it's not. We are just one whole thing with this small ball that it's floating on the universe called Earth. And I think it's all so unbelievable, and we are in such an amazing world. Yeah, sometimes it gets ugly and sometimes it gets aggressive, but we can choose what we focus to look at. Of course, we are always going to have ups and downs in life, but we can choose if we want to stay down longer or if we want to, you know, pedal and get out of there and, you know, what we can look. And nature is really my therapist. Can I say like this? Yeah. I don't go to a therapist. I go to the mountains or I go to the ocean. And that helps me so much. Like when I go free diving, I just empty my mind and I have to focus on my breathing and my heart rate and how relaxed I am. And after 3 or 4 hours free diving, I come out of the ocean like a new person. And I always used nature in my favor, like, for good moments, for bad moments, always. And it helps me a lot.
Where's your career at right now? What's going on with you? Like right, you know, in the past, you know, year or so.
Well, it was very challenging. Like I didn't quite plan to be a mom when I was 39. So, but it happened. I wanted to be a mom a little later. I just wanted to, you know, enjoy the most I could. But after Cora was born and also the pandemics, and I had a big fracture on my leg. So it all came together. I was for more than 2 years, almost 3 years without being so much in nature, challenging myself and doing everything I love. And that was the big lesson for me. And it took a lot of me and I had to look inside and I had to find other ways of, you know, working out things and disappointments and frustrations and pain. So it was also very good. It took me out of my comfort zone and out of the things I like a little bit, but it was for evolving. I think we are here to evolve as human beings. And in that sense was very intense for me. But now I want to go back and do the things, you know. I think I learned the lesson and I did whatever it take, and I want to go back climbing and doing everything. And why not take my daughter with me? She's such a good company. She's so lively. She's always smiling. She's a super cool baby and she's beautiful and she loves the ocean. Like we live by the beach and there's not one day that I go to the beach with her because she loves to sleep by the ocean, listening to the waves. But when we go there, she wants to go in the ocean, you know, and she wants to swim, no matter how cold the water is. So she's such an ocean lover, and I want to take her to those things with me and to go on these adventures together.
In the future, you know, do like in the next year, 5 years, what are some of the, do you have any big milestones that you're trying to plan next? And also keeping that in mind, when you are thinking about as you get older, you know, you're still very young now, but get older, you say, how do you know how to navigate your body to make sure that you're able to accomplish, because that push and pull, that desire, that adventure, that reasoning that you have to where it might endanger your life. So what do you have planned and how do you navigate that thought process?
So here is how I've always thought about life. Everybody's going to die.
Right.
No matter what you do, you are going to die. Since the day you're born, you have to know that. But not many people live their lives because they fear things. They fear living life to the fullest. And sometimes they fear doing whatever they dream of. But they are going to die anyways. So I just think, like, of course, you don't have to put yourself into irresponsible and crazy situations. But if you study a lot and you plan a lot and you get your strategy and you put a lot of energy for that and still your heart is super happy when you go do that, just do it. Because if you die doing that, you're going to die very happy. It's you know, I don't know. I think not many people live life to the fullest, as I said, but we are all going to die. So we might just die doing what we love and going after the things we enjoy.
You know, we got a little bit of everything today with Karina. We got Zen. It's a very Zen philosophy, Taoism that you just explained. We got the elements. We have some poetry. I love this. This is just wonderful. Please tell everybody how they can find out more about you.
Well, they can find me on Facebook or Instagram, a little bit on LinkedIn. It's at Karina, K-A-R-I-N-A, Oliani, O-L-I-A-N-I. And yeah, I have a website as well, www.karinaoliani.com.br for Brazil. And thank you so much for your invitation, for this opportunity. It was a pleasure taking part in this podcast.
My pleasure. Everybody, when you check this out, you're in for a long adventure. Like, I mean, anybody that's like ever wanted to, like, you know, travel around the world in the ocean, up in the mountains, everything, you know, a full 360 experience, you're going to get it with Karina. Thank you so much for sharing today. Absolutely amazing.
Thank you, Michael. See you.
That was Karina Oliani. I always talk about consciousness, but I can only imagine the consciousness that she's picked up, not just meeting people all around the planet, but actually doing things all around the planet that has just created an experience, a full 360 understanding of not just the people that live on this world, but the world itself. Here's a great quote that segues right into that. "Look deep into nature, and then you will understand everything better." Albert Einstein. Thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hanging out with you all on the next episode. All right. Have you guys been to longshotleaders.com? That's where you can check out all of the guests and the bios and the backgrounds and more. Also, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what we do, give us a good rating. Tell your family and friends to come by and listen. It's going to make you feel nice and toasty inside. Every week, we'll be delivering knowledge, creativity, inspiration, exasperation, perspiration. If it ends with a shun, basically, you're going to find it here. All right. Thank you for joining us. And in the great words of Bill Murray in the movie Caddyshack, friends for life, I say.